Yeah, that one's in there. Good evening. I'd like to call the Health Commission meeting for Monday, June 14th to order. I'll start with the approval of the minutes from the May 10th meeting. I'll entertain a motion to approve.
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, next we'll open it to public comment. Any items that are not scheduled items and are within the scope of the Health Commission, if you'd like to speak, please come forward at this time. Seeing none, we'll move on to item number four, a resolution. Surely to be.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, it's not just any old resolution. My name is Jim Patterson. I'm on the Board of Supervisors, and I am here representing the Board this evening to present a resolution to Pam Hetherington, and I'd like to read that before I present it to Pam. County of San Luis Obispo, California, honoring Pamela Hetherington for 13 years of outstanding service to the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission. Whereas the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission was founded by the Board of Supervisors in 1994 to serve as an advisory board to the County Board of Supervisors and the County Public Health Department on matters of health care in the county. And whereas the Health Commission, whose mission is to work with and on behalf of the residents of the county to preserve and improve the quality of health for all people within the community, meets monthly in a public venue and is a cooperative effort among volunteer consumers and indirect and direct providers of health care services. And whereas Pamela Hetherington was appointed to the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission by the Board of Supervisors in 1997 and to date is the longest serving commissioner. And whereas Ms. Hetherington served as the commission's chair for the past year and has been a driving factor in enhancing the cooperativeness and openness of the Health Commission process, and whereas Ms. Hetherington brought a wealth of experience and perspective to the Commission, ranging from medical office management to land use planning to environmental impacts on community health, and whereas Ms. Hetherington has championed community-wide access for all to quality, preventive, and primary health care, and has staunchly promoted the county's role in ensuring the availability and accessibility of health care for low-income residents. And whereas, drawing from her environmental background, Ms. Hetherington was instrumental in establishing the Pesticide Use Task Force within the Health Commission and worked tirelessly with the Public Health Department, its Environmental Health Division, and environmental advocates to reduce the agricultural use of toxic chemicals near existing residents. And whereas, as a liaison to the Health Commission, Ms. Hetherington served on the Domestic Violence Task Force for many years, and through her service on the task force, helped raise public awareness about the serious impacts of domestic violence. And whereas Ms. Hetherington also represented the Health Commission on the Preventive Health Grant Committee, where she again showed her dedication and caring commitment to the health of the residents of our community. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby recognize and honor Pamela Hetherington for 13 years of outstanding service to the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission and our residents.
Well, I knew it was coming, and I promised I wouldn't cry, so much for that. Thank you.
Well, Pam, I just want to add that the board recognizes, and not just Pam, but all of you, the effort that you put into serving the entire county and protecting the health of our citizens. And we very much appreciate your service. And Pam is the longest seated member on the commission. It speaks to your dedication to it. And we very much appreciate it and wish you well in your retirement. And we're anxiously waiting to see what you'll be doing next.
And guaranteed I will be doing something next.
I'm sure of that. And I'll just stay here for the next item, if that's okay.
That's perfectly fine.
Pam. I just want to thank you for keeping us on TV. Thank you.
Oh. Well, you belong there, because there are people out there watching. And again, you serve a very important function.
Okay, we'll move on to certificates of appreciation, recognizing Penny Shemousis and Martin Craven for their service to the Health Commission.
And also on the list is Pamela Munson, and none of them are here tonight, but we do have certificates from the board for them, and I'll just quickly read it. It's a certificate of appreciation with gratitude for your dedicated service to the health and well-being of San Luis Obispo County residents as health commissioner, and it has their term of service on the certificate, and Jean will be sending these out to the individuals since they're not here tonight to present them in person. So, again, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson. It's really an honor to have recognition for the commissions. I know over the last 13 years, sometimes we've waged some pretty significant battles, and you know, I think that we appreciate one another, and we know that many of our public appreciate what we do.
Absolutely, I agree. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, moving on to the next item, Drug and Alcohol Services documentary, Wasted. Is Kim Mott here? Hi. I'll let you introduce your companion then. Thank you.
I would love to. I'm Kimberly Mott with San Luis Obispo County Drug and Alcohol Services, and I'm with the Friday Night Live and the prevention programs at Drug and Alcohol Services.
Hi, I'm Caitlin Butler. I am a junior at Atascadero High School, and this is going to be my second year in the Friday Night Live program there. We're here to present the Wasted documentary. It is no surprise that alcohol is the number one youth issue for kids today. And we asked kids why they say they drink, and they said because they're depressed, there's nothing better to do, to have fun, or to hide their bigger issues. Now, where do kids get alcohol from? From older friends and siblings, they buy it or steal it, or parents provide it.
I know that you've heard a bit about our documentary, and we're excited to share that with you this evening. Alcohol is the most frequently used substance by youth in California. And while drinking rates have declined, we are seeing far too many young people still engaging in high-risk behaviors with drinking, drinking games, drinking and driving, and the issues along with alcohol that sometimes don't get discussed. This year, San Luis Obispo County Friday Night Live and Friday Night Live Youth countywide have created a documentary focusing on underage drinking. Our goal is to bring awareness to our local information and create venues for conversations that will lead to change. So with that, we'd like to share with you our documentary, and I believe, Bob, that's your cue.
Thank you. probably the biggest issue for youth right now is drinking.
911, what is your emergency?
Yeah, we have someone on down that's not breathing anymore.
Okay, is this person with you at 811?
Yeah.
Do you know why?
I think he's been drinking too much.
One, two, three, and four, and five. Come on, breathe for me, baby, breathe, my Adrian, breathe!
These students represent San Luis Obispo County youth. Meet our junior hires. By this age, 19% have used or experimented with alcohol. In 2 years, this number will change. At this point, the number has increased to 46%. By the time they graduate from high school, as many as 71% have used or are using alcohol, and 36% are engaging in dangerous drinking activities.
Well, certainly that trend is very, very disturbing. It does show an alarming increase as students get older.
The underage drinking scene is binge drinking oriented. Parties where students, young adults, are drinking to excess, and they drink with that purpose.
One of the problems that we see with the minors that are drinking is that they don't understand the impact that alcohol has. One of the statements we frequently hear is, I thought I could handle it.
The real goal in drinking is to get, as they would say, wasted or highly intoxicated.
We have minors that are coming in at 0.26, 0.30. Which is bordering on lethal levels of alcohol.
It is well established that alcohol is the leading cause of death among youth. It contributes substantially to motor vehicle crashes, suicide, rape, and family and school problems.
The physical brain of a young person is different than the physical brain of an older person. In youth, the prefrontal cortex, which is the front part of the frontal lobe of the brain, hasn't completely myelinated. That portion of the brain is responsible for decision-making, judgments. And now you give it a drug, a toxin, into the system that essentially removes inhibitions, impairs judgment, essentially puts them at risk for a large number of issues. And we see that in the emergency department.
But what is shocking is the way our youth are drinking. That this has become normal.
The drinking scene in high school is like undercover. It's kind of people leading multiple lives where they want to go out and have fun and party, but they don't want people to know.
We live in a small town, so that it's either you find something illegal and stupid to do, or you go to a party, you hang out with a bunch of friends, and you go drink. And just not remember the night.
I've seen cases of where people are injured, where people are sexually harassed.
It seems like everyone's doing
it. People that are drinking to the extreme, and there's not really an in-between.
Not, like, socially drinking, like, full-on getting hammered.
Drinking games, beer pong, shots. You name it,
they are belligerently drunk and they're falling over. They're just collapsing.
Their approach to drinking is to get completely wasted.
Well, when you drink, you're drinking to get drunk. I've never talked to anyone while I'm having one or two. It's always, I'm going to have one or two and then a shot and then maybe like a four more shots and then like some Jaeger bombs. Just like, it's never just a beer.
But I've been where kids drank so much we couldn't wake them up, and girls have drank so much that they take their clothes off.
A few weeks ago at our school dance, people were taking shots on the way to the dance.
I've kind of seen like the people like you wouldn't expect to go to parties, go to parties. So that's definitely becoming the norm.
Experts refer to these activities as high-risk drinking. Simply defined, high-risk drinking includes the following behavior. Binge drinking, or having five or more drinks within a few hours. Participating in drinking games and activities. Drinking and driving. Getting drunk. Or experiencing social, school, or legal problems due to alcohol use.
We see some pretty horrific things in the emergency department on a regular basis. We see young women that wake up that just aren't even sure if they've been raped. I sewed up 23 people in one night. 23 people I sewed up in one night. People that were left with disfiguring scars on their faces, people that have been hit with bottles that have been punched. It creates a lot of unhappiness, and we see that on a regular basis. That night, in fact, I had one young woman who was so intoxicated that she stumbled out into the street and was hit by a car. And when she was struck by the car, somehow she lacerated her, she literally cut half of her tongue off. And in the process of that, she bled about a third of her blood volume into the street. When she came to us, she was hypotensive. She was literally drowning in her own blood from the laceration to her tongue. And, you know, we dealt with it. You know, we saved this girl's life. But this is the thing that people don't see. They look at it as a big joke. And it's not. It's people's lives. It's suffering. It's a great deal of suffering that's created from this.
So where does it begin? Why are young people drinking? And why are they drinking like this?
Fresh, smooth, real, Bud Light.
Not even for some Bud Light?
Make it a Bud Light. It's all here. When the target's refreshment, a hard Mike's is good to find.
And you smearing off black ice, a crisp, clean bite.
Alcohol advertising saturates our world. Advertisers spend in excess of $5 billion annually. It's everywhere. And the message it sends is clear, that alcohol is the best way to have a good time. And this message is clearly targeted at an underage audience. In fact, according to a study by the Center on Alcohol Marketing and Youth, more underage youth see these ads than adults. These ads aren't just for beer, wine, and hard liquor. Increasingly, we now find a wide range of alcoholic drinks that look much more appealing, especially to the young drinker. These drinks are known as Alcopops. Sweet, colorful, and made to look like a soft drink, these are quickly becoming the drink of choice for many youth.
They do make the products look a lot like non-alcoholic things that teens are used to. Plus, they don't taste like hard alcohol or beer. So definitely a lot of younger kids are using them.
And more recently, alcoholic energy drinks.
Everyone now knows about Monster and Rockstars and all those which don't have alcohol. But then they come out with the Rockstar 21 and products that really look similar, and there's so much name brand confusion.
One of the most disturbing things about these drinks is their appearance. At this grocery store, we see our typical energy drinks and soft drinks. And right next to these, alcoholic energy drinks, which seem to blend right in as part of the selection. In addition, these drinks are extremely high in alcohol content, up to 9% alcohol by volume, or double that of beer. And these drinks can contain 3 pints in 1 can. That's like drinking 6 beers in 1 drink. And because of their unique blend, they are easy to drink.
Now it's a little bit more socially acceptable, not only to the parents, but now also to the kids. They learn from their parents, and a lot of them, as we see in these hosted parent parties where a parent will say, we'll buy all the alcohol as long as you drink it here.
I think that a lot of it is their parents aren't aware of how much it can affect them. And they're thinking, like, they're in the mindset that, hey, well, if they're at my house, then I can control what they drink and I can control who they're with and what they're doing.
I've seen people steal it from workplaces. I've seen people steal it from their parents. I've been to a house where my friend's dad just gives him the key to his alcohol case.
It's one of those things that's like, well, I know where the cupboard is in my parents' house, or I know somebody who can get it for us. It's
extremely easy. It's to the point where you can ask a friend of yours who graduated 2 years ago, and like, all right, just give me some money, I'll get it for you.
If an adolescent wants alcohol, they can get it.
The presence of two colleges and all the alcohol-related problems that come with a college town has a major impact on the city and our youth.
As far as college towns go, we're pretty similar to what a college town problems centered around alcohol are. And that is that we have the high school we have. So we have young students mixed with little older students all in the same area.
I'd say a good percentage of 80 to 90% of all calls that we ever deal with are fueled by alcohol. Oftentimes when we get out there, the parties that are involved are heavily intoxicated, whether it be for a drunken public, where they're, you know, they've consumed so much they're unable to care for themselves, or they become a danger to others, or you know, while they're involved in these incidents, they're doing things that they wouldn't normally do. Whether, you know, when it comes to fighting and assaulting others, using weapons on others, driving drunk, getting in traffic accidents. So those are all things that we would deal with on a normal basis.
Adults are committed to change. They are changing norms that condone parent-chaperone drinking parties, advocating that policies are enforced to keep our community safe, and refusing youth easy access to alcohol through their families, friends, or local merchants. The greatest influence on a young person's decision to drink alcohol is the world they live in. The number one protective factor against youth alcohol use and abuse is a strong parent-child relationship. The Parents Who Host Lose the Most campaign is designed to educate the community on the legal and social consequences of adult chaperone drinking parties. Merchants and bar owners play a major role in reducing youth access to alcohol.
I don't, nor does any of my staff, condone underage drinking, so I think that's an important thing, especially here on the Central Coast, because I know a lot of that goes on. And also we do give incentives to them. If they do happen to confiscate a fake ID, they get rewarded. So that's another big thing.
And college organizations are helping to send a clear message on their stand against underage drinking.
Casey's Pledge is about a girl who was really proactive against drinking and driving and in Friday Night Live, and she was on her way home for her mom's birthday and she was hit and killed by an 18-year-old drunk driver. And so now we have these bracelets that say Casey's Pledge on them, and it's a pledge to not drink and drive and to not get in a car with a drinking driver. Because when you come to college, you have so much freedom, and you have to really, that's when you can choose to be really responsible and choose the right thing to do and to not drink and drive.
Well, with the death of Carson Starkey last year, the Greek system has really undergone a culture change, specifically with regards to the way we educate our new members. We understand that as college students get older, and you know, they get further along in their experience, they're less likely to change and they're less malleable. And so where we figure we can make the most impact is in our new members. So starting last year and continuing this year, we are really trying to instill the values of, you know, brotherhood, sisterhood, academics, character building, everything like that into our new member curriculums, and really trying to take the emphasis off of what we've seen in the past, which is, you know, the Animal House style social gatherings and parties, and really letting Greek life shine for what it really is. All right, so a little backstory about Carson Starkey. Last year, Carson Starkey was a new member or an associate member of the fraternity known as Sigma Alpha Epsilon. He was a great kid, loved life, really active, really involved, great, smart kid. And when he came to Cal Poly, he wanted to get involved in Greek life. He took part in an event known as Brown Bag Night, which in essence, the new members are given, you know, quantities of alcohol and told to finish them before they leave, you know, leave a room, leave an area. The results of the autopsy when they finally did it, but his blood alcohol was in the area of 0.44.
You know, I think one of the most important messages I could give to you is, first of all, take care of yourself and take care of your friends. Not everyone is using. You have your whole life in front of you, and the longer you postpone drinking or using any kind of other drugs, the better off you will be. So it's important to take care of yourself, also important to take care of your friends.
From the financial cost of emergency responders, medical care, treatment, and law enforcement, to societal costs of pain and suffering, neighborhood disturbances, and other crime.
Youth and communities are working together to change social norms on alcohol use and to reduce youth access to alcohol. Like parent and merchant committed campaigns, social host ordinance, social marketing to change the culture of youth and alcohol, and youth issues conferences.
Our goal is to bring awareness, but besides that is to engage in the conversations around solutions. We know that underage drinking is a issue in our communities. We're seeing it right now with the Carson Starkey criminal cases that are now being handled in our court systems. It's our job at Friday Night Live and in drug and alcohol prevention to bring awareness to it, but we have been engaging all year in some of the solutions that we can all take as community members. It is a healthcare issue, and we appreciate you, Sue, coming and making light of this and letting us share our documentary with you. They say out of the mouths of babes, the youth in this video are all local San Luis Obispo County young people talking from their own personal experiences. And it's our job as adult allies to support them and to assist them, to work with them in creating change. So with that, thank you very much. And do you have any questions for Caitlin or myself?
Any questions from the commissioners? Commissioner Arnold?
Yeah, thank you for coming down and giving your presentation. And of course, you've given concrete things that you're working on. But the more basic question that I want to go back to is, at the beginning, they said, why were the students drinking? And I think one of the reasons they said they were depressed, and one they said they were bored. And I can remember that far back when I was in high school, I was neither bored nor depressed. But luckily for me. But, you know, what are you thinking about? Why are they depressed? Why are they bored? And how you're going to approach that so you can, you know, head them off earlier before they're tempted to start drinking?
That's a great question. And as Caitlin mentioned, this year we hosted a youth issues conference or a town hall meeting at all of our local high schools to engage in conversation with school administrators, city council members, health commission members, along with young people. We brought in people from the mental health field. We brought in transitions mental health. I believe you saw Slow the Stigma, in really presenting a conversation about the broader issues. Why do young people drink? Where are young people getting it? And what do we have as solutions to both of those issues? So the conversations have started. I think that we have a community now that is finally willing to not just listen and acknowledge, but actually take part in some change. And so we have are really starting to bridge the relationship between drug and alcohol and mental health and young voices to be able to come up with realistic, attainable solutions for them. Does that answer your question a little bit? A little bit? Yeah. We know that young people, one is acknowledging the fact that young people have issues like depression, and they are dealing with stress in their lives, and acknowledging that they have that and giving them resources so that they don't have to turn to drugs and alcohol to self-medicate or escape, if you will.
Any other commissioner questions? Commissioner Warren.
Thank you very much for bringing it here. It's just better than I remembered.
Good. Well, yes. Thank you for...
Yeah. And I was curious, do you have some other venues? Are we going to be seeing more of this video this fall?
Yes. We presented it at all of our area high schools. Like I mentioned, this year we had the opportunity to share it with administrators and community members along with students. Caitlin actually facilitated a very large youth issues conference at her high school, which helped hopefully build a wellness center on their campus, which would be new to that community. Our goal is to roll this out this next year, again, for young people, but for adults as well, with the agreement that they will assist in working on change and that it's a solution-based conversation that follows the video. We don't want to just talk about the issues. We're looking for action to make a difference for the future.
I'm curious, what about school boards, city councils, some of those? Are you looking to show it to them and work with them?
Mm-hmm. We were very successful in Atascadero and Paso Robles with both their city council and their school administrators, as well as school board members who were willing to actually look at some of the changes on campuses around policy for athletic ethic contracts. Mm-hmm. Looking at making some change, making a mandatory for parents to see this video at back-to-school night so that it becomes a mandatory video for them, for their awareness, because it's always not my child. But if you look at the statistics, that would be a lot of children, so we can't deny not my child. Yes, we have been working on that. We've been really successful, and I would say, countywide, our school districts have embraced this video, have embraced the documentary and the statistics. We will have new California Healthy Kids survey results out now, and we will be able to compare it and hopefully make some changes in the future. But hands down, we've had a great support. You can see from the people that were in the video, we've had a lot of people rally behind it and get it out to the public. And thank you.
Any other commissioner questions? I have one. You know, what they said in the video about some of these behaviors being handed down from things that they see their parents do, what happens when you run into the good old guy that, you know, drank beer at 14 and has survived and is productive and his 14-year-old kid is now drinking? How do you envision handling that?
That's going to be an ongoing challenge because we currently have a system that parents can provide alcohol to minors in their own homes. We are trying, a couple of our local law enforcement agencies over the last few years have had parent patrols to help curb that. We have social host ordinances intact, like in the city of San Luis Obispo, and we're working on others in other areas that would help law enforcement in just that enforcing the adults who do provide it, because there is a mentality that adults believe if they provide it in their home, then it's safer. So then we start sharing all of the other issues that come around with underage drinking in your own home, like the unprotected, like I was like, Caitlin took it off her list earlier, but it was, you know, the unprotected or unwanted sexual advancements, mm-hmm. the sexually transmitted diseases, the violence that comes from underage drinking. And while adults might think that they're providing a safe environment because young people are not drinking and driving, they fail at times to remember everything else that accompanies underage drinking. So there's a push for awareness there. We also have to work on some of our laws that say we have young people that unless you're super, super intoxicated, they tend to just get small, minor in possession. But actually our young people, or they get cited and released to a parent. And I think we need to bring more awareness that there are more consequences to that. And whether it's law enforcement or health related, there are more consequences.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, thank you, Kim. Oh, I'm sorry. I just remembered something that was an issue a few years back when you talked about the parents hosting the parties. And I know there's a period of time where the parents were literally going away for the weekend and leaving the kids at the house, and then a big party would ensue. Whether the child had planned it or not, the word gets out. Is that still a big issue?
Caitlin has been really involved in the Parent Committed campaign, which is designed to see the video and then sign a commitment not to provide alcohol to minors, not let your young person participate in underage drinking, and magnets right on the front of the refrigerator, because we know young people can get it straight out of the cabinets, that you're not condoning. So it's setting boundaries from the get-go and really defining your boundaries, setting expectations with your young person so that when that happens, you know, are you calling your son's friends or your daughter's neighbors? Are you setting up the boundaries so your young person cannot participate or put themselves in a vulnerable situation? So, good question.
I have something to say about that. Our youth issues conferences that we have had, like Kim was saying, they are meant to start the conversation. And in part of those, we talk about that. We talk about the fact that a lot of kids and their parents haven't had the conversation about how their parents feel about the issue. And we believe that just starting the conversation and having parents have the information to be able to sit down with their kid and lay down the law and tell them where they stand and what their point of view is going to help to be effective to reduce that.
Anything else?
Any questions or comments from the public? Please come forward if you do. Okay. If not, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Kim. Thanks, Caitlin. Okay. Yes. Our next item concerns the precautionary principle. I don't think we have a presentation this evening. We don't have one listed. So do you want to lead this discussion, Commissioner Arnold?
Well, thank you. I would just start out by making a motion, which we can discuss. I would move that this commission...
Is it on?
Yeah, okay. I would make a motion that this commission vote to support the precautionary principle and urge the Board of Supervisors to ask our legislative lobbying people to support the adoption of the precautionary principle on the state and national level.
I think for the audience, we ought to explain what it is.
The conversation stemmed out of the President's Cancer Panel, Reducing Environmental Cancer Risk. And I think that in the document on page 103, it actually goes into a recommendation of the precautionary prevention-oriented approach should replace current reactionary approaches to environmental contaminants. I don't know if anybody's had the time to read the document. I think the first 96 pages were pretty comprehensive. I did a little background search on the precautionary principle. It actually came out of the 1998 Wingspread Statement when the international community got together to try and prevent any more, how can I say it, contention between the introduction of chemicals into society worldwide and the ramifications. I think there was a great interest in making sure that whatever we put on the market was not harmful to the people that were going to be exposed to it. And I think subsequent to that and more currently, we have a lot of things in our drinking water, in our air, that had they been tested in the first place, probably would have never been released. So I think what the precautionary principle is asking is that rather than a reaction to harm already done, that we take a precautionary attitude towards the 80,000 chemicals that have already been put out there and that we're exposed to, and the relentless expulsion of chemicals into our water and air and land. Commissioner Enns.
I think that that's pretty succinct, but if I can be a little more succinct.
Go ahead.
I just downloaded, and what came from this Wingspread statement was when an activity raises threats of harm to the environment or human health, precautionary measures should be taken even if some cause or effect and effect relationships are not fully established scientifically. That kind of says it, don't you think? It's kind of like saying, let's adopt an approach to common sense.
Even more succinct.
Sure. Who would say no? Now, alternatively, you can adopt something that then makes anything going further very restrictive. But if you're, so that's the only downside of saying, oh, well, we'll adopt this principle. If it's very strictly interpreted, then they're saying, well, you can't do anything unless you prove that it is not harmful ever in 100,000 million years, and that's not realistic either. But so what is it that we are supporting here, Commissioner Arnold?
Just what you read. So it is rather general. It doesn't give an exact timeline. But and thanks, David, for bringing it up. Since this had come up before, I was just assuming that people knew about it, and that was a mistake on my part for assuming that. But the other thing I wanted to bring up was, if the Board of Supervisors, when an issue comes up, they usually let the public speak first, take their input, and then the board has its discussion. So we have at least one member of the public who brought this to our attention last week, and so maybe we should ask for their input, even though we already have a motion on the table here.
Yeah, I was going to let this discussion go and then ask for public comment.
Okay.
Commissioner Greena?
There is some history, isn't there, already with this principle in the county?
Mm-hmm.
And can someone let us know what that is? The Board of Supervisors has already done something?
They had signed a... ...2001, I think. They proclaimed Stop Cancer Where It Starts Month, and part of that resolution covered the precautionary principle that I think... I'm reading from David Broadwater's piece. In fact, David, do you want to come up and at least highlight that portion of it, of what the Board of Supervisors had put in their Stop Cancer Where It Starts? Thank you, David.
Yes, I'd be glad to.
2001. Name? Your name?
Oh, David Broadwater, sorry.
Thank you.
In 2001, a local group called Stop Cancer Now approached the Board of Supervisors to designate October 2001 as Stop Cancer Where It Starts Month. And a lot of the focus in the whereas clauses was about environmental contamination and cause of cancer cases from prostate to childhood leukemia and other things like that. And I didn't include that in my earlier comments to you, but I did include therefore be it resolved, and a couple of the whereases that go into the precautionary principle, kind of explaining how it works. Basically, I didn't bring my copy of the briefing paper that I gave you, so I can't read word for word exactly what it was that they said. But it's basically the idea that when there is a potential threat or potential harm and sufficient evidence of, you know, harm due to a particular substance, that regulatory or governmental intervention in trying to prevent that exposure can be initiated without having absolute ironclad scientific proof that harm is caused, which is the model that we have now, the risk assessment model, which puts the burden of proof on those who are exposed to get a lawyer, get a laboratory, you know, do all kinds of stuff to make, you know, to prove that, whereas a precautionary principle allows action before that stage. I don't know if that...
Yeah, I think you got it just right on target. Thank you, David. Commissioner Williams?
Well, from what I have read, the way I understand it is the burden of proof is no longer on the victim, but it is on the purveyor, producer, etc. of any even potentially harmful substance to prove that it's not harmful. And isn't that the basis on which we established the FDA?
I would say yes. Any other comments from commissioners? Commissioner Greenan?
Nobody likes cancer, and we all are against poisonous chemicals in the environment. But that's pretty general, and I think this is a pretty important issue. And wouldn't it be better if we called in key players to discuss it and talk about who's involved, who is going to be impacted by this? What is it going to mean that if someone brings in a new fertilizer, that we're going to be looking at that in our county? Is it if there's a new medication that's brought in, or are we talking about bigger issues? You know, if we're going to ask the Board of Supervisors to recommend and to enforce this principle, I think maybe we need to talk about it and get the citizenry involved with it and get a snowball going to build it up, and once we can get the Board of Supervisors to, if they want to, if we present a good case, then it would seem to me that instead of just quickly discussing it, we need to sell it. Anyway, I agree it's extremely important, but I don't know if most of the public realizes what it is.
Any other comments from the commission? Commissioner Warren?
Yes, I feel as Ed does. I'm not well enough informed about this to make any kind of decision, and I feel we owe it to our public to have more education, not only for ourselves, but for the public, too.
Commissioner O'Dell?
Yeah, I would agree with Susan completely.
I'll open it up to the public at this time. Did anybody want to make comment?
Good evening. My name is David Broadwater. I strongly urge you to send a recommendation to the County Board of Supervisors that the county implement the precautionary principle by adopting an ordinance, which has been done by other cities and counties, directing all county departments accordingly, and including the precautionary principle and their state and federal legislative strategies. Those of us who work to prevent excessive exposure to environmental contaminants were not surprised to read in the President's Cancer Panel's annual report that our current regulatory reactionary risk assessment regulatory system is broken, obsolete, and weakened by, quote, undue industry influence. We were not surprised when the panel reported that Americans are subjected to an unacceptable burden and grievous harm from being bombarded continually with myriad combinations of these dangerous exposures and widespread exposure, which is grossly underestimated and could have been prevented, and that our babies are born pre-polluted. Those are all quotes from the President's Cancer Panel. We were presently surprised, however, when the panel's by the panel's emphatic endorsement of the precautionary principle by making that regulatory framework its first and primary recommendation. It also calls for the involvement of local government, environmental and public health advocates, the public, and the media in the effort to, quote, enforce rigorous regulation of environmental pollutants. That does place the burden of proof on the any entity proposing any particular activity to verify the safety of that activity, switching the burden of proof away from the exposed to the person who is planning the activity or the introduction of a chemical. The system that we have now is broken, and the risk assessment method that's used, a lot of people think that it's really solid science when you have a risk assessment method of deciding what's an acceptable burden or an acceptable risk from environmental contamination. That's not the case. Data gaps, when they study pathways of exposure, show up all over the place like Swiss cheese, and they stuff assumptions and plug those holes with a lot of assumptions. So what the precautionary principle does is it allows the public, local government, health and environmental advocates to be involved and to intervene in the introduction of potentially dangerous chemicals into the environment based upon sufficient evidence of potential harm, rather than waiting until proof is given, or what has been called by some commenters the dead body method of dealing with this problem. So I strongly encourage you not only just to, as Mr. Arnold suggested in his motion, send a message to the state and federal lobbyists for the legislative agenda, but also to ask the board to look into this. And it is right that it may take some time, some public education, some study. We've had task force on issues like this in the past. The board may want to do that as well. But to put it in an ordinance and direct county departments, department heads, to implement the precautionary principle in their various departments in the county. So I strongly urge you to pass a resolution and ask the board to get involved in this, so we can improve the way we regulate. And there is a definite role for local governments in this. It's not, a lot of people think, well, this is up to the federal government or the state government because they're the one that sets the standards. Not so. Local governments definitely have a role in this area. Thank you.
Commissioner Arnold.
Mr. Broadwater, got a question for you. It's my understanding that the city and county of San Francisco adopted the precautionary principle, and you mentioned that other counties have, or cities. I'm hoping you can come up with a specific example of how they have used that in a local situation in a county or a city.
Yeah, I don't have the records in front of me, but I do know some specifics. You're right. The city and county of San Francisco did pass the precautionary principle, and as a result, one of the things, I believe it was that entity, there have been a few other cities and counties that have done the same, but they were the first in the state to ban arsenic-treated wood because of the levels of arsenic that were in it were leaching into the ground and potentially exposing. That was totally legal, totally okay. EPA said the risk was acceptable, just like they do with spreading sewage sludge. They say a certain amount of lead or mercury, you know, exposure is acceptable. And they also ban bisphenol A, which is a component in plastics, which is an endocrine disrupting compound and can be very serious for exposure to young children. And they were actually legally challenged by some people in the industry, and they prevailed. So they're on good, strong legal grounds when they do that. So yeah, there are local governments who take the initiative, and it actually has a positive effect.
Commissioner Arnold, I have a copy of the white paper that resulted in the adoption of the City and County of San Francisco. I'll leave it with you. Okay. But just to follow up on your question there, one of the things that was stated in the white paper for San Francisco was the human exposures. And if I could just take a minute of your time, that out of 9 volunteers, each one had about 167 chemical contaminants in each, including 53 chemicals linked to cancer in humans and lab animals, 62 that are toxic to the brain and nervous system, 55 associated with birth defects or abnormal development, 55 chemicals toxic to the reproductive system, 53 that are toxic to the immune system, and 55 chemicals for which no health information was available. And, you know, I think we've read enough in our area to know that the goby population, which is a fish, which is an indicator, is coming up with both ovaries and testes from some chemical that they've been exposed to. So we know the ramifications. I think the precautionary principle is long overdue. I'm glad that the Board of Supervisors has at least introduced it in one shape or another. And come on up, Jonna. Welcome. Please state your name.
Jonna Kincaid. Good evening. I have a few thoughts. I also want to respond to some of the hesitation that's just been expressed with this. I can understand that there might need to be more dialogue, information, public involvement on this issue, but inevitably, when it comes to cancer and enforcement of chemicals, there is a lot of talk and not enough enforcement, not enough action on what's really happening. And inevitably, the longer we spend on this, the higher it goes, the more that the conversation will be dominated by the big industrial chemical companies and those who also have a lot at stake in this. We are in a state dominated by industrial agriculture, and that is why I urge for a local approach that goes from the bottom up into this issue. And so I do urge you to adopt the precautionary principle and to consider that, you know, for a long time, a lot of people have known that environmental toxins and contaminants cause cancer, and now that the president's panel on cancer has admitted that, they have went from one of the few who have yet to admit that to the people that now accept what we have known to be obvious for a long time. Now there's the industry, you know, big pharmaceutical companies and whatnot that are, you know, still lagging in the dust a bit. But I think too that while this can lead to better regulatory enforcement and greater awareness, especially local ways, it also can come as an indicator that we need to go on a cultural shift from a treatment of genetic diagnosis and palliative care to a recognition that environmental pollution and preventative care needs to get more resources, it needs more focus, and it needs more consideration from doctors on up to regulators and everyone in between and beyond. And so I think this would be symbolic as well as an important step in regulating what we need to do and cannot waste any more time on and let it be further undermined and co-opted by those who like to do that with science and public debate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kincaid. Anybody else like to step forward and speak to the issue? If not, I'll bring it back to the commission for further discussion. Commissioner Williams.
It seems to me that adopting a principle is not dictating how that should be enforced, but asking someone who wants to put a potentially harmful substance into our food, our water, our air, asking them to prove that it's not harmful instead of waiting until someone is harmed doesn't seem to me rocket science.
Commissioner Arnold, did you have anything else? Yes,
I just want to thank the people in the public who have come here to speak to us. And even though there hasn't been a lot of publicity about this, I feel as a consumer representative that these two people are very good representatives of the public. And if the public knew what was going on here, I'm feeling I do best representing the public by supporting this panel adopting the precautionary principle.
Commissioner Innes?
Could you restate, could we have the motion restated?
I think I have it. That the commission vote to support the precautionary principle and urge the Board of Supervisors to ask legislative lobbying people to support the adoption of the precautionary principle at state and national level.
So what you're saying is that we urge our lobbyists to support that principle. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Or to look for legislation that it might impact.
Commissioner Greener?
Let me restate again what I'm getting at here. I think our position, our goal here is to educate the public, is to help educate the public. And I think it's very important for us to get all the information out that we can on this subject I will vote for it, but I hope it doesn't stop there. I mean, this is something that I think we either need to have another subcommittee to look at. We need to have speakers in here and talk about what it is, mainly so we can get public information out. EcoSlow, professors at Cal Poly, the farm industry, you know, the chemical industry. What are we talking about? I agree it's very important, but I think everyone needs to remember that it is our duty here to educate the public as well, not just protect them because we think they need protecting, but to also educate them. And so if we vote to have the Board of Supervisors adopt this, I don't think we should let it drop. I think if we adopt it, then the burden is on us to educate the public with maybe an entire month of discussion, nothing but this, and let the information come out from there.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Yeah, something more to say, of course.
Yeah.
No, I Commissioner Arnold said we should support this principle, and that sounds reasonable to me, that you can support a principle. I would only object to saying that what I would object to is that we support that there be an ordinance, because then you're jumping into a whole different ball game. So it would be up to anybody who wanted to bring that up as a further agenda item or an educational item. I mean, that's fine, but I see no problem with supporting a concept.
Commissioner O'Dell.
But that's not the motion. The motion is, would you read it again, please?
I thought you said to support the...
I mean, that is the motion and other things.
The motion didn't include an ordinance.
It
said that the commission vote to support the precautionary principle and urge the Board of Supervisors to ask legislative lobbyists to support the adoption of the precautionary principle at state and national levels.
I think we should just, through the Board of Supervisors, I don't know, the lobbyists and all that, is adopting a principle.
I would like to throw in a couple cents worth here. What if we went the route of supporting the report of the President's Cancer Panel and with a recommendation
for the Board of Supervisors to work with the Health Commission in educating the public about the precautionary principle and the protection of human life and the environment from that aspect.
I would go for that one. Oh, that'd be fine.
We have a motion and a second on the floor. Would you entertain a revision to your motion?
You might have to repeat that motion again.
Okay. That the Health Commission recommend to the Board of Supervisors to support the report of the President's Cancer Panel, and that the Board is urged to work with the Health Commission to educate the public on the precautionary principle. Oh gosh, and that's where I lost my. Did anybody catch the rest of what I said? I was busy trying to write. To protect the health of the people and the environment through education. Anybody want to finish my sentence? Go ahead, Lynn.
It seems like it's just could simplify this, just add on to the existing motion. We were going to support the
precautionary
principle concept, something like that is what he said, and urge the Board of Supervisors. That's where we got bogged down, I think, Commissioner Arnold, was urge the Board of Supervisors to do what?
Lobby.
Talk to our lobbyists. I think we're agreed. We want to maybe have some educational information here for the public.
Okay, then
I think everybody sort of agrees to that. Just stick that on the end somehow.
Yeah, and that the Health Commission encourages the Board of Supervisors to work with the Health Commission and educate the public on what the meaning of the precautionary principle is.
I thought you had adopted what the President...
Yeah, I did, but then they were talking otherwise.
All right.
Well, how about this? The Health Commission supports the findings of the report of the President's Council on Cancer. Was that the appropriate name is?
Can I jump in? Since we have already had a motion, we need to do something with that motion and then write a new motion. What you got to tack onto it substantially changes the intent of the original.
Okay. I'll fix that. I'll withdraw my second.
Okay.
Now we're starting over.
Unless somebody else
wants a second. I was going to jump into the
Go ahead, Dr. Bornstein.
I'm feeling a bit that if I don't quite get what the precautionary principle is in terms of local action, now I'm very pleased to hear the examples that Mr. Broadwater brought forth. But I feel like there needs... I'm not clear if the precautionary principle is only at the level of new products coming on the market and that they not be brought to market until such time as there can be evidence that they are not harmful, putting that burden of proof on the manufacturer? Or does it also apply to existing products that we have local jurisdiction about control of availability to our residents? And so ultimately, I'm feeling like we, the Commission on Public Health, needs to further explore what we're agreeing to and saying adopting. I mean, conceptually, I get it, but the implementation of what it would mean to the Board of Supervisors to take action as an ordinance or to compel their lobbyists to bring it forward is not clear to me. And so I'm wondering if it would be clear enough to the Board of Supervisors as to what is being asked in reiterating their adoption of that principle. It's easy to say something in a resolution that, yes, we support this principle. I think we've all said it here tonight, but what would be the action steps? And I think that that's where I'm having a hard time understanding what comes out of support of the principal in terms in terms of the ability locally to really affect.
In my mind's eye, it would be the choice of looking at your practices within the county and saying, okay, do we use Clorox or do we use vinegar? You know, one's got a total ramification of chemical, whereas another one is a natural product. And I think that's where the precautionary principle starts at the local level, is just looking at the things that you're doing on the day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
Commissioner O'Dell.
Yeah. Have we discussed this before? This commission?
No.
I mean, if you did, I missed the meeting.
Yeah. No.
No. Well, I feel totally uneducated about this, and I really have difficulty dealing with it because I'd like to hear the whole thing and what's happened to other places who've adopted this. What have they done? You know, what's happened? And what does it really mean? Because it's a motherhood statement. Yeah, you know, it's great. Okay. We all agree with the statement. But what does it mean? And so that's what's really bothering me.
Commissioner Grainer.
Sorry, I tend to be the troublemaker here. Let me tell you what I'd like to see, and whether or not this flows with our conversation. I would love to see a meeting where we could have people, first of all, someone from the Board of Supervisors or a representative of those people, letting us know what sort of local control do we have. What can be done on the local level, and then talk about what we can recommend on the state level and federal level. Then I'd like to have people come in and give specific examples of where the precautionary principle would help in decreasing these toxins in our environment, so we all know what we're talking about. I can't agree more that it's important, and I am fully behind the precautionary principle, but I think we need more information to decide on what we can do about it.
Commissioner Arnold?
Yes, just to respond to David O'Dell, I previously at a meeting several months ago brought in this sheet on the precautionary principle, the wingspread statement on the precautionary principle. So that would have introduced you to it. And then at our last meeting, Mr. Broadwater went over it again. So it has been at least mentioned at two of these meetings. But I'm certainly for more education, as Ed mentioned. But we do have a president's cancer panel making a specific recommendation. And they are educated people, worked hard to produce a report, and so I would, you know, I'm going along with what you say, Pam, that we should tell the supervisors we support that report and that it also recommends that we adopt the precautionary principle, and let's learn more about it and see what we can do. So.
Any other comments?
Can I answer a question?
Yes, David.
Yes, I'm not trying to advocate anything, but Dr. Borenstein asked and said that she was unclear, maybe other folks are, between how the precautionary principle applies to new products, new chemicals, or ones that are already on the market. And it applies in both cases. New products, of course, it switches the burden of proof onto the manufacturer to verify the safety of the product. But when it comes to products that are already on there, local governments and other agencies that have passed the precautionary principle, if there's something that's already on the market, it allows them to intervene and or in some cases even ban or control the use of the substance due to the prevalence of some evidence of potential harm, so that there can be intervention even with products that are actually on the market. So I just wanted to make that clear that that's both are true.
Commissioner Greenock.
Is there a
a definition? I mean, we're talking about the precautionary principle. If I were to look it up, is there a set definition of it, or does it have room for interpretation?
It's actually listed in the recommendations of the cancers panel document. On page 103, it actually defines what they support as far as precautionary. Principal, I'd be happy to read it. It's quite long, though. Yes, Commissioner Williams.
I think that this one sentence in the Wingspread statement pretty much covers it. In this context, the proponent of an activity, rather than the public, bears the burden of proof.
Commissioner Warren.
I'd like to ask that we table this until a future meeting, whether it be August, September, October, whatever, and have a presentation. Suggested, and I'm just feeling like there's just not enough information for us or for the public who we're all here to represent, and to take an action on something that we really haven't had a commission's presentation or discussion about. And it doesn't mean I may not agree with it, but I don't know what all the consequences are, what's all the ramifications around it, and I just personally don't think that there's enough information for the commission.
I'm trying to imagine who would give a presentation on the precautionary principle at the local level. A lot of this has come from the cancer panel, from other cities that have been aggressively promoting the health of their residents and their environment. So, you know, short of somebody contacting somebody in San Francisco to find out who they used as experts, you know, might be a good course of action. Commissioner Williams?
Could I suggest that we go back to a suggestion that was made earlier that we form a committee of the commission to study this, a subcommittee?
Commissioner Arnold?
My thought was just send it to the legislative committee. And the report is online, or you can get it printed out. I got it printed out at the library. It's 140 pages. And for the public, anyone in the public who's listening, you can read it on your computer or get it printed out at the library. It's the President's Cancer Panel, Reducing Environmental Cancer Risk, What We Can Do Now. That's what they're saying, now. So I understand people who are concerned about there's going to be a new regulation and there are going to be unintended consequences. I know that happens. But we're not suggesting that the supervisors go out tomorrow and adopt an ordinance. Like any other ordinance, it would be run through a process. Everybody could take a look at it, and the supervisors are not going to act overnight and do a new ordinance. All we're saying is we think we should be more cautious, and the President's Cancer Panel is backing us up. So.
Commissioner Ent.
I think that there's room here for part of our program, however, because we are educating the public, and none of us most of us, some of us, have not read this cancer, the report of the President's Council, so, and introducing that in a more educative and public way might be very useful. So I would support Commissioner Garena's idea that we have included on a future agenda, and I believe Commissioner Warren also mentioned that we include it on a future agenda and have a program built around it so that then we can, if from there we want to do some sort of a motion based on the information that we're listening to, that's what I would support. Oh, I don't know. We don't need a motion for that, do we?
Pam, you did a motion and I didn't hear anyone second it.
No, we started fresh.
I'll second Pam's motion.
You'll second my motion on supporting the findings of the report of the President's Cancer Panel and a recommendation to work with the Health Commission to educate the public on that issue. Got that?
I recommend to the Board of Supervisors to support the findings of the report of the President's Cancer Panel.
Panel and work with the Health Commission.
To educate the public.
To educate the public
issue?
On the impact of that document at a local level, even. Okay, there's a motion and a second. Take a roll call. See if we can get at least some support there.
Start. Commissioner Warren? Commissioner O'Dell? Commissioner Garina? Commissioner Ans?
No.
Commissioner Williams? Commissioner O?
Yes.
Commissioner Hetherington?
Yes. So it'll be up to you all to schedule some educational presentations. Touche. Anyway. Yes, Commissioner.
We've had a suggestion from Ed that we do a subcommittee. I want to send it to legislative committee. Dawn, what was your
task force?
So perhaps we should decide, if we do want to do more education, we should decide at this point how we want to proceed with that.
Commissioner Williams?
Well, would that come under the purview of the legislative committee or the education committee?
Well, I think we ought to establish a task force to do it, not an existing committee. Just like we did with the pesticide group and other ones. Because that's my suggestion, task force. And also remind you that we have our next meeting is the organization meeting, and if we probably don't have committees right now, and we're going to be forming committees in July.
So you could do that at your retreat.
We could do it at July retreat.
Remember, include the public, include, you know, factions from throughout.
Yeah, the task force, right, yeah, does include not only the commissioners, but other people.
Yes.
Right.
You remember, David. Thank you. Okay, Dr. Bornstein, it's your turn.
Hi, thank you. I can't help but listen to all this and think there's a list as long as my arm of all the things that I'd like to do as the public health department, where I think ultimately a lot of this needs to reside, and I'm prepared to talk to you about the budget that got passed today, and I'm sorry to always be so parochial, but I feel like there is a lot of good and important work that needs to come out of this, and I'm thinking health education, environmental health, me. I'm always hard-pressed to identify anyone who has an extra 15 minutes in their week, let alone day, to shift priorities, but so it goes on the to-do list as it does yours, and I will make every effort to keep this issue alive along with the related issue of pharmaceuticals in our waste stream, because I know those were, so with that, the health agency budget was adopted today. It was the third year in a row in which our agency sustained reductions. 10% was the adopted budget at $2.2 million. The state cuts are unknown, but will likely affect us as an agency and in public health. Though the word on the street is that we won't really know anything until midsummer or later, that it is proving to be another very difficult legislative session for the state to come to terms with a $20 billion deficit. some of the things that they cannot do as a product of federal health care reform are good news for our constituents, particularly low-income folks. So with respect to Medi-Cal and healthy families, the federal health care reform bill put a stop to any decrease in eligibility in those programs. It did not, however, it was not terribly clear on what can be done with alterations in the benefit package. So some of that is still being bandied about, like vision and dental health care and things of that sort. Also with federal health care reform, though, come some opportunities that I think stand to serve us very well. The most significant one that's coming up very soon, just today, was announced, I'm not remembering the dollar amount, $60 million, I believe, $60 million available in the first round nationally to provide money to states to support evidence-based home visiting programs. And our nurse home visiting program, which has been very successful, I think you've heard me before talk about it, has been ratcheted back a little bit in terms of staffing and is definitely at risk because it is a place where county puts quite a bit of general fund support. So this is welcome news to think that there might be another funding stream to continue to support that program. Our nurse home visiting program is aimed at the perinatal period to identify high-risk pregnant women and to work with them both prenatally and postnatally to avoid some of the discussion you heard earlier, particularly around substance abuse and the implications that has for the outcome of the birth and the child's development. And a host of other things that put these women at risk for having poor birth outcomes and child development concerns. So that is good news. And there's another piece of good news that came out of the budget today, which is our oral health program manager position was approved. And so we will begin to immediately establish that position and recruit for it. And It will be a twofold position, one to continue the work that has been begun by the countywide coalition to develop and implement a strategic plan that includes education, that includes primary prevention services, access to dental care, and ongoing countywide coordination. So we're excited about that, but the other part of the job will also be earning one's keep. And the way we were able to create this in this budget climate was by identifying revenues that would support the position, which are both grant-based from First Five as well as service-based, so Dentical reimbursement for services to be provided in Head Start centers, state preschools, WIC clinics, et cetera. One other thing on the funding end I want to mention is that we just recently submitted a Title X funding request. Title X is the federal Social Security block grant for family planning services. Ever since I arrived here, I've been asking staff why it is that we don't get that funding source. I'm used to it being a traditional funding source for public health family planning services. We do provide family planning services. We have definitely cut back on our ability. We eliminated 2 years ago the ability to provide that service at one of our clinics, but we do retain the services in North County, and the demand for it is growing. So we did now submit a grant, and you know, we'll wait and see. And the last thing I just wanted to mention and catch folks up on in terms of the public health involvement in the ongoing search for some answers to the APCD, Air Pollution Control Board's Control District's report on the causative nature of high pollutants on the Napomo Mesa from OHV utilization, that a committee has come together as directed by the APCD board to work on a memorandum of agreement with between three parties: the APCD, the Board of Supervisors at the county level, and the State Parks Off-Road vehicle division, and the first meeting went well, and there's hope that that memorandum of agreement might be able to be prepared prior to the next APCD meeting. So that is my report. Thank you.
Thank you. I got a question for you. We were talking about cancer here recently, and I've got a column here by Nicholas D. Kristoff, and he says, he notes that 41% of Americans come down with cancer. Now, do you think that's believable? And if so, is our county above or below that rate?
The rates I've seen in other scientific publications is 1 in 3. Risk of lifetime cancer diagnosis. I believe that that includes somewhat benign cancers, including facial skin lesions of basal cell carcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma, which are very prevalent and very curable, but nonetheless require medical intervention. And so, yeah, I haven't heard as high as 40%, but I definitely have heard as high as 33%.
There was a report at the last meeting. They've been talking about some of the sober living environments and residential treatment and housing issues for people in recovery. And Michael Axelrod from Project Amend was the guest speaker. He has a detox and the only licensed residential treatment program in the county. And he's having to adjust, of course, that economics and everything else, that ideally you'd have a 90-day program, and they've had to create a 30-day and then continue to work with him afterwards just simply because of cost. But he's urge people to call him, and he'll work with them.
No report.
No report.
No report.
No report.
Yes, I do have something I'd like to share. On the 4th of June, I attended a roundtable at the Marriott Courtyard on postpartum depression, which is now sometimes called perinatal mental issues. We do have an organization, Alpha, in this county that is working very hard on that, as are many other agencies. It is definitely an issue for the safety of children that postpartum depression be treated immediately.
Nominating. You have items. Yes, I do. So I'd like to present the recommendations of the nominating committee for officers for this next year. We're sorry that Pam is leaving, and we're going to miss you, and you've done a wonderful job, and thank you. For chair is Ed Garina. For vice chair, Susan Warren. And for secretary, Lynn Enns. I would like to make that motion.
Okay. There's a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any dissension? No. Congratulations, okay. Ed, Susan, and Penny. Penny. Lynn.
Yeah. Penny is not here.
And your second?
For the second item, we'd like to recommend the nominating committee that Gene Raymond be on the commission as a direct provider and Mary Jean Sage as an indirect provider be a member of the commission. I would so move.
Is there a second?
Yeah, I'm second.
Oh, okay.
And I'd like to mention that they're both here in the audience.
That's what I was going to
ask. Yeah, okay.
After we have the motion.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any dissension? No.
No, I'd like to. Could you ladies come forth and...
go ahead, David. Tell me, give us our life story.
You know, just say a few words. Come on. One at a time. Welcome and congratulations.
Well, I'm Mary Jean Sage, an indirect provider. We have been residents in the San Luis County for about 10 years. I have a healthcare business consulting firm where I work with hospitals, physicians, anybody who provides healthcare services, and we primarily work with them from a business standpoint. My particular expertise is Medicare fraud and abuse, as well as Medi-Cal fraud and abuse, and reimbursement for healthcare services. So I'm looking forward to being part of the group and being involved and serving on some of your committees. I found your discussion very enlightening, and I think that certainly education about the topic will be very important, and perhaps I can lend something to that discussion. So thank you for your vote.
Thank you very much.
Well, my name is Jean Raymond. I'm a direct provider. I work at French Hospital and Arroyo Grande Hospital. I have been a resident of San Luis Obispo County for about 5.5 years, but I'm no newcomer to this area because actually I was born and raised in the San Joaquin Valley and my husband went to Cal Poly, so I do know the area and I do know the health issues here in our community, so I think I can be an asset to this commission.
Thank you very much. I have one more thing there.
Okay.
Now, we still have two vacancies on the Health Commission, and that's consumer positions. And I would like to ask and remind everybody, a consumer is not a direct provider or indirect provider, but is a consumer. So there, I would like to ask also that anybody in the public that would like to apply to the commission, you can call Gene White at 781-5520 if you would like to apply to be on the commission. Or simply call the public health department and ask for Gene White. And the same with the commission. If you have friends and things that you think would be a good member, let's encourage them. Go ahead. I'm through.
Thank you, David. I just wanted to add that as far as I know, the deadline to apply is June 30th. Is that correct?
Yeah.
It's ongoing, but we did put June 30th because we'd like to conduct interviews early July for these two seats.
I encourage everybody out there who is a consumer of health care to please apply. It's an experience of a lifetime. Very educational and enlightening. I can attest to that because I'm the oldest one. There's another thing here for prospective future items. Do you want to throw some ideas out or wait?
Before you leave that topic of the nominations, I just want to make clear to the public and remind the commission that those nominations go to the Board of Supervisors for appointment.
Do we know when they're going to the board, Dr. Bornstein? Don't ask.
Well, it will not be before July 13th, which is the next opportunity for being on the board agenda.
Okay. Okay, prospective future items, so do you want to table that? Okay. All right, I won't give you my list then, David. Thank you all, and good night.
Thank you.